Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Well, the Israeli election 2019 contradictory exit polls show Gantz-Netanyahu tied, but the numbers seem to favor the far right-wing coalition. According to Haaretz, shocking exit polls destroyed Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's hopes of an easy victory in the Israeli election today. The exit polls published immediately after voting ended were contradictory. In some, Netanyahu's rival for the premiership, Benny Gantz, held a clear lead, while others showed the two candidates virtually tied. Most importantly, however, after tallying up the exit poll results for the numerous small parties in the race, it was clear that neither leader would be able to easily assemble a majority sufficient for a ruling coalition among the right and left wing blocs, although the numbers do seem to favor the right. What's going on in Israel right now? Well, for insight into this, we go to Tel Aviv and my first guest. She's an analyst and producer of Loud and Clear, Nicole Roussel. Nicole, good morning. Thanks for staying up and welcome back.
Thanks so much. Yeah, it is 1 a.m. here, and the election night party here at the Likud headquarters, there's lots of music going, but speakers haven't even come on yet since there's, like, really no news, as you were saying.
So what's the sense on the ground right now with what Haaretz is reporting? Is there confusion? Is there tension? Are people happy? What's going on?
I mean, people are definitely celebrating. We've had a number of BB chants. We've had lots of flying the BB. BB, obviously, is of course, as your listeners know, the nickname for Netanyahu. We've seen lots of Likud flags flying, lots of Israel flags flying. Saw some Trump flags flying. Also, people are excited to be here. People are excited to be up and watching and waiting for the prime minister to possibly make an appearance. But, yeah, to your point, I mean, the exit polls are not clear. You know, I've talked to a number of Likud Knesset members. The Knesset is the parliament here in Israel, and you know, they're all putting a good spin on it, which I think we would all expect them to do. They're all saying, well, you know, the Israeli soldiers, their votes haven't probably been counted yet, and they often vote for the far-right bloc, so we're waiting for those, which seems possible. But, you know, a vote here or there or a seat here or there, is it going to make a difference? The difference that we won't know for a while is whether some of those smaller parties make it over that 3.25% threshold.
What is your sense of the turnout? The results in the polls, is that due to unexpectedly high turnout, unexpectedly low turnout? What's your sense of turnout?
The turnout so far is looking like it's ever so slightly lower than 2015, but nothing, you know, substantively lower. However, the caveat there is that Likud is Netanyahu's party, and Likud has acknowledged that they sent right-wing activists to Palestinian communities to put up cameras. They're saying it was to make sure that there was no fraud in the Palestinian communities at their polling places. But what we know is that it has driven turnout down and that Palestinians have not turned out today, despite what I've heard has been a really massive get out the vote effort in by some of the Palestinian parties. So, you know, their efforts were obviously worked well. And even though they, you know, the Likud is not saying that that's why, it seems pretty clear that their strategies work to try to keep Palestinians home, you know, because of fear.
There are two interviews that you did with voters that, in my opinion, showed a great contrast in interest. Let's hear these two, and then we'll discuss them.
Were there issues that were really important to you today?
No, really no.
Yeah?
I don't believe in anyone.
How did you choose who to vote for?
I didn't. I just pick a note.
Really?
Really. That's what I did.
But it was important to you to come out?
Yes, it's my duty as a citizen.
Gotcha.
Not a full duty, but, you know. I didn't do it all right, but I did my duty.
First of all, are you interested in saying who you voted for? You definitely don't have to. It's completely up to you.
No, I'll say it's fine. I voted for Gantz this time.
Okay. And what were the issues that you feel like were really important today?
I just feel that, you know, our current administration has been too long in power, and it's a healthy thing for democracy to change.
So that was a very, very interesting contrast in terms of a woman who said, I just picked one, but I showed up because it's my duty. And the other voter, who was a Gantz voter, and made it very clear that he knew the issues, and we edited this. But I believe also this particular guy was from the United States. So can you put your finger on some significant policy differences between Likud and Netanyahu and Blue and White and Gantz that have resulted in this turnout? Or is it a matter of people just wanting change or a combination of the two?
Yeah, I think you really hit the nail on the head there, Wilmer, at the end. I think both interviews are actually pretty reflective of the fact that this campaign has been run as either you're either pro Netanyahu or you're against him. It hasn't been really been run on any sort of policy basis. And I heard from two people who said, you know, it's not representative, but I was only there for an hour, and I heard from two people saying almost the exact same thing, that they voted for Gantz, who is the main opposition candidate opposed to Netanyahu, and there was the Blue and White Coalition. And they voted for the Blue and White Coalition and Gantz because he was a Netanyahu, and Netanyahu had been in power too long. So they didn't say anything about what they liked about Gantz, didn't say anything, you know, any sort of difference between Likud or not, but they just said he'd been in power too long and that it was a time for a change. So I think, you know, this campaign has been run really without any policy issues on the table. So when someone says, well, I think I should go vote, but I really don't know how to, and I don't, you know, I don't really know. Someone else told me they thought politicians were all cheats and that they felt like they should go vote, but like it was kind of random how they did it. So similarly, right, it's just hard to pick when like no one's inspiring.
Were you able to identify the ethnicity of the first voter, that female voter?
I was not. I believe she was Jewish. She had a head wrap and she was with her husband with a yarmulke on, but okay. I'm not sure of the ethnicity, no.
Okay. Okay.
I will say Tel Aviv is almost exclusively Jewish Israeli.
Now, the second voter, he, and we didn't hear this on the clip that we just played, but I believe he identified himself as an American citizen. Can you really see or feel an impact of American Jews that are in Israel and voting in this election?
Yeah, it's funny you should ask that because, yeah, he identified himself to me as an American and was seemed very proud to be here and to be voting. He was not the only one. Again, I wasn't at this polling place for very long, but another American came out and in a full American accent told somebody that they shouldn't be electioneering so close to the polling booth. So, I mean, I definitely think there's a lot of Americans here. You know, we know that a lot of Jewish Americans have come to Israel to populate Israel. And as Israel is looking for more Jews to kind of come here and take over the land that they've conquered, you know, we know that people have come from the U.S. So I think for sure in a longer sense, there are a lot of Americans here who have probably made a real difference in the polls. Where they're voting, you know, I think that probably depends more on where they live. And I think those attitudes seem to be driven by, you know, whether they live in Tel Aviv, whether they live rurally, whether, you know, kind of who their influences are. But we definitely have seen Trump influencing here. As I mentioned, there is literally a Trump flag being flown by, I think, a 19 or 20-year-old here at the food headquarters tonight.
Is there a deeper message beyond solidarity between the United States and Israel that Trump flag is? Are people walking around saying, let's make Israel great again? Or what is there any message just other than solidarity between the two countries that flag would represent?
You know, I'm not sure. I haven't heard that. I haven't heard a lot of reference about the U.S. tonight, at least from the Knesset members I've been talking to. But it is an interesting parallel that we know the U.S. is also a settler country, right? I mean, Europeans came and settled here in the U.S., or rather in the U.S., I'm not there, but in America, and slaughtered and kicked out lots of Native Americans in very similar ways that happened just 70 years ago here. You know, the real difference is just time. But yeah, I mean, so to me, that's kind of a message tying these things together. I don't know that people are thinking about that explicitly, but Donald Trump certainly represents that sort of, you know, he ties himself in with white supremacists, with really far extreme right people, just like Netanyahu's been doing. And I think that is probably one of the reasons they're such close friends.
You had a very good interview with, I think his name is Eli Hazan. He's a press secretary for Likud. Let's go ahead and listen to that.
So first of all, if Likud wins tonight, what would actually happen, given that no one's ever been indicted before in the prime minister's seat? What would happen to the coalition?
I think, as a lot of MKs have declared, we will form the coalition. don't forget, you have to understand the context of the right block.
Yeah.
We see it as a political persecution. And for us, it's meaningless on some sense, on our political sense. It doesn't mean that we don't respect the Supreme Court or the legal system. But for us, it's meaningless because we consider it as a political persecution. As long as Netanyahu were not completely, you know, under trial, it doesn't mean anything. We will form the coalition. And again, follow the other candidates of the political world from the right bloc. They will support Netanyahu.
And in terms of Netanyahu's comments about the annexation, I mean, how likely is that to happen? Is he serious about that? Is the Likud party serious about that? And when would that happen?
Two things about it, two comments. First of all, according to the Likud constitution, we have the right to have sovereignty in the whole land of the...
Right, and this is something that Likud has talked about in the past couple of years.
About a year and a half ago, approximately, in the end of 2017, the Central Committee of Likud has decided about it.
Yeah.
Now, I want to make clear about one thing. We are not speaking about the annexation of all Judea and Samaria. We are speaking about Territory C, and moreover, some territories in Territory C. Because the international community sometimes refer to that as a complete annexation. No, not at all. In that case, if Likud will decide about complete annexation, I will leave my party. We are not speaking about that.
And Area C, I know, is majority Jewish Israeli,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it also includes some Muslim and Christian Palestinians.
10,000.
And so that, I mean, is going to maybe affect voting in some ways in Israel. Is that,
we are speaking about 10,000, only 10,000. It's not more than that. And I guess they will get an Israeli citizenship, but it's far, far away from now.
Okay. And then lastly, why? So I know Likud agreed that they had placed these almost 1,300 cameras today at Israeli polling places. Can you just tell me why that happened?
Because we know for a second...
Fraud.
We know that for so many years in the Arab sector, and please check it, it's not a matter of racism, it's a matter of fact. There's a lot of fraud, and we wanted to check out that we are... You know, at least stop this kind of phenomenon.
So it was purely just for, like, watching what happened?
Of course. I mean, what can we do besides that?
I don't know. That's why I was wondering.
Yeah, yeah. But, again, look at the facts. For instance, I can give you an example. In 2011, Raviv Drucker, the reporter, the commentator of Channel 10, even he reported about the fraud in the Arab votes. He spoke about the primaries in the Labour Party at that time.
That was Eli Hazan, and please correct me if I did not get his name correct. He's press secretary for Likud. I found it interesting. First of all, he says that the indictment or the pending indictment of Netanyahu doesn't matter. It only matters if he goes on trial. That sounded a lot to me like Donald Trump talking about the witch hunt.
Yeah, it sounded the exact same to me. And actually, a Knesset member tonight from the Likud party brought that up and said, well, it's just like Donald Trump. And look what happened with him with the Mueller report. But, you know, it appears to me that these are two entirely separate situations. But, you know, I suppose we will have to see what happens. I will say, though, that pretty much every Knesset member I've talked to tonight has said almost the exact same thing. It doesn't matter. He's not even called guilty yet. I mean, we're jumping ahead, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, I do think, if it comes down that he's guilty, I think we can all assume that that will have a huge role in the kind of political implications.
It was also very interesting for me to hear about annexation because he said, well, we're only talking about Territory C, which I think is the West Bank, which is really what they want. But if they go too far, I'll leave my party. Let's hear a bit of the representative from the Blue and White Party, another very, very good interview that you did.
Well, so thank you so much again. I just have a couple questions for you and love to hear your thoughts as a spokesperson for Blue and White. So first of all, there's been an increasing gap in the income and wealth of Jewish Israelis during Netanyahu's term. And so I wanted to hear kind of what policies Mr. Gantz and the coalition might put into place to really prevent that rising income inequality that he's kind of overseen.
Okay, so I mean, we're a party that's committed to dealing with the domestic challenges that Israel faces. For us, one of the key things is bringing down the cost of living. Mm-hmm. So one of our flagship policies is free education from birth to age 3, which will save the average Israeli family 25 to 30,000 shekels a year for each child. Mm-hmm. And we want to improve Israel's education system and get it back to being amongst the best in the world. I think education is a key part of giving everybody an equal opportunity to succeed in life.
So some are saying in this election that occupation is fine as is, and we've kind of heard, I think, from Israel as a whole that maybe occupation is fine as is, and we should kind of continue as as things are, and that any interruption in the status quo could trigger violence. But on the other hand, as you know, Prime Minister Netanyahu just announced that he was interested in annexing more Palestinian land and additional territories. And other people have said that before. This is not necessarily a new thing. I just was wondering, I guess, what differentiates blue and white diplomatic and security policy from Likud's diplomatic and security policy?
Well, I don't accept the term occupation. I think there's a dispute over territory in the West Bank, and we have a dispute between us and the Palestinians. We're committed to trying to find a diplomatic solution. On the security side, I think there are more similarities than differences. We certainly believe we need to restore the deterrence when we're facing terrorist organizations in the Gaza Strip. And we have a right and responsibility to protect our civilians. In the last year, we had over 1,100 rockets fired from Gaza at Israeli civilians. And we have a responsibility, every government has a responsibility to protect its civilians from that kind of terrorism. When it comes to the diplomatic side, we believe in trying to find a diplomatic solution. We've come out in favor of a separation between Israel and the Palestinians, in favor of a regional conference led by Israel, the Palestinians, and the what we call stability-seeking Arab states, or the moderate Arab states, in order to try and move forward on a diplomatic solution.
Mm-hmm. So were the Blue and White Coalition to come into power as the government, would they support annexation?
No, we don't support annexation, but we do believe that the settlement blocks will be a part of Israel at the end of a negotiation process. We've come out against annexation and against one-sided moves in general. We won't support a second disengagement, for example. Mm-hmm. So we believe that everything needs to be done through a negotiated agreement. But the settlement blocks that the Prime Minister is talking about in any negotiation will end up as a part of Israel.
And included in those negotiations, would you be open to some sort of peace process between the Palestinians and the Israelis? And could that include Donald Trump and his potential peace plan?
So we're all waiting to see the president's plan. And if we win the election tomorrow, then we will certainly be eagerly working with the Americans to see what the plan is and what it entails and how we can move forward with it. America is Israel's closest and most reliable ally. It's a very deep friendship based on mutual values and interests. And so we'll certainly work with the American administration the day after the elections. And we'll see what they're presenting and work from there.
So, Nicole, Blue and White believes in diplomacy, but at the end of the process, the settlement blocks will be a part of Israel. So that sounds to me like we're just going to take it, no matter what.
It's really remarkable. I mean, all of those interviews and the ones I've done tonight, there's so much code switching going on, you know, in terms of, are we saying occupation? Somebody told me tonight it's not annexation, it's applying Israel's sovereignty. There's so much code switching going on. And there's also, as you just mentioned, so much kind of talking out of both sides of your mouth, right? Because you're saying you're not going to annex and you don't support the annexation policy that Netanyahu just announced, but the annexation policy he just announced is, like you said, part of the West Bank, Area C, and that's where a lot of the settlement blocks are. So if you're talking about taking the settlement blocks into Israel but not the rest of Area C, you're not talking about a lot of difference. It's the same. It's pretty much the same thing, right? I mean, it's hair splitting at this point, but they want to be able to say, oh, we're further left than Netanyahu, so we're not going to annex, we're not going to do this, we're not going to do that. But it's absolutely talking out of both sides of their mouth, for sure.
Is there any idea at this point how long it will take for them to determine the winner of this election?
You know, I'm hearing maybe 5 a.m. our time, which would be another 4 hours. It's just really not clear yet, but we'll definitely be here waiting. And then, you know, in terms of the coalition and who's actually, you know, tapped to do and build that coalition and how those negotiations go, I mean, that's maybe another, you know, could be up to 4 weeks even. Maybe not that long, but that's how long they have. So, we're just going to wait and see.
And final question, we have just about 30 seconds. What happens if at the end of that four-week period, they still can't form a coalition?
They could get an extension for another 2 weeks. After that,
sounds like Brexit.
Could have someone else.
Okay. All right. Nicole Roussel, thank you so much for staying up with us this morning, your time, and look forward to your contribution tomorrow to the Critical Hour.
Thanks, Homer.
Thank you, Nicole. All right, folks. Well, that's what's happening right now on the ground in Israel. The polls have closed. The election is over. The votes are being counted, and they're now just trying to figure out who won this thing and who's going to be tapped with building the next coalition. What we find out really at the end of this, it's a matter of how far to the right you want to go. Because Blue and White and Likud, they're basically walking in lockstep with each other. Just Blue and White might be a little further to the right than Netanyahu, which is not saying a whole lot. With that, You're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you are tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, Attorney General William Barr appeared before Congress today for what was supposed to be a routine budget hearing, but it was overcome by discussions of the Mueller report. Barr tells Congress he will deliver the report within a week. What are we to make of all of this? Well, for insight, we turn to my next guest. He is a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Daniel Lazar, as always, Daniel, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Thanks for having me.
So Attorney General Barr walks into Congress today. I think he knew pretty well that what was supposed to be a budget hearing was going to turn into what it did. Your thoughts on what you saw, your thoughts on what you heard.
Well, I think it's good news. I'm looking forward to it. I really want to see that final report, as much of it as it can feasibly make public. It will answer a lot of questions. I don't know what those answers will be, but I'm on tenterhooks like everybody else.
Are we today, at the end of this hearing, where we pretty much knew we would be after Barr released his very bad book report on what might be the 400-page Mueller report, in that didn't really tell the Democrats what they were looking to hear? Now they are demanding release of the full report, release of the full report. Are we, at least as we sit here and talk today, where we pretty much knew we would be?
Yeah, I'd say so, yes. Barring certain details of timing, but yeah, more or less. I mean, but the Democrats, they should be careful what they're wishing for, because it's not that no one knows what the final report would say. And I have a certain suspicion, and actually maybe even more unfavorable to the Democratic case than Barr's initial very brief summation.
How so?
Well, I mean, I'm just interested in all the things that Barr has not confirmed. I mean, he did not confirm. That the original WikiLeaks email dump was engineered by the Russians, or that it had anything to do with the Russians. That's the most important point. Essentially, the whole Guccifer 2.0 is a very, very minor aspect of the whole controversy. So he has handed down indictments dealing with one very minor hack. And one very minor attempt to use Facebook to sway opinion, although we aren't even really sure exactly what the Internet Research Agency, I guess it was called, in St. Petersburg was really up to. So he has really not come up with very much so far.
To your point about the Democrats need to be careful what they wish for, are they beating a dead horse in the context of, we had been told by all those in mainstream media that the president is a Russian agent, that the president has been engaged in treason, that the president was going to be led out of the White House in handcuffs. Varying outlets have told us varying degrees of those scenarios, none of which have proven to be true. And based upon Barr's book report, a lot of that stuff we know now just isn't true and is not going to happen.
We were also told that the Russians had hacked
right. The
DNC computers, and that was a report issued in April 2016 by CrowdStrike, this California cybersecurity company. But as far as I can tell from the information that is out so far, there's no confirmation of that.
Okay.
In the Mueller report, and that was the one of the most important aspects. So it looks like the Democrats may have come up dry on that as well. That may be a false alarm. It looks like Mueller was not able to confirm that hack. But no, once again, I don't want to go too far out of the limb here because I don't know what the final report.
We haven't seen the report. Understood.
Right.
Understood.
Right.
But so far, the Democrats seem to have some egg on their face.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And if I understand what you're saying is, it, instead of being one egg over easy, if they keep pressing this button, it might wind up being two or three eggs over easy that they've got to deal with. So if you put on your political analyst hat, why do they keep beating this horse? Is it because they have no options left?
Because they put so much money on this horse. Well, I don't know what the proper analogy is. They have gone so far with this whole crusade, they really can't back out now. So they're sort of, you know, in for a dime, in for a dollar. And there's no turning back. But I'm saying that when the final report is issued, the Democrats may wind up with even more egg on their face. That's a distinct possibility. On the other hand, I don't have my crystal ball, but maybe the report will actually contain some really good meat for Democrats to seize on. I don't think so, but it's possible.
That takes me to my next question, which is something that we have discussed before, but I don't hear enough people making this delineation, and that is the difference between the criminal versus the political. I haven't seen the report, as you have not seen the report, but I think I'm fairly comfortable in saying the criminal elements of this are pretty much behind us. Now, understanding that there are still other investigations being done, understanding that the Southern District of New York is doing its thing, but those issues I separate greatly from the alleged Russian hacking issue and all those other things that Mueller was looking at. So I don't see any other indictments coming down here. I don't see the president being let out of the White House as a Russian spy or for treason. Now.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely not. Right.
Right. So that's the criminal side. But there is still the political side, which is the possible impeachment side of the conversation. And it is quite possible when we read the report that there may be some impeachable stuff in there.
I can't see that.
Okay.
I really can't see that. Mueller has said there will be no more indictments, or the Barr said it, actually.
Right.
There will be no more indictments. We know that there was no Russian collusion between Trump and Putin. So I can't imagine what any kind of criminal finding there could be that any way would merit a finding of high crimes and misdemeanors. That's a prerequisite for impeachment. That seems really unlikely, impossible, in fact.
Oh, okay. All right. I hold that out, not hoping for anything, just leaving since I haven't read the report, leaving the possibility open that is a possibility. That's my only point there.
I don't see where it would come from.
Okay. So in terms of a couple of the other things that, in terms of Barr's testimony today, when he was asked the question about hate crimes in the country and hate crimes being on the rise, and he said he wasn't aware of any data to that effect. I mean, he really left me scratching my head on that one.
Well, that is a head scratcher. I quite agree.
are you not reading the paper? I mean,
he's clearly towing the Trump line. He's saying what Trump wanted him to say. Just as Robert Mueller back in 2003 went before Congress and told Congress what the Bush administration wanted him to say, which is that Saddam Hussein was the source of all terrorism. And his regime was bristling with WMDs, weapons of mass destruction. So these guys are servants of the administration. They say what their bosses want them to say, and I don't think it makes any sense at all. Because clearly, there's an increasingly dangerous atmosphere out there that to me is plain and obvious.
Congresswoman Nita Lowey from New York asked the Attorney General if the White House had been briefed on the report or had seen the report, and Barr punted that one. I've said what I'm going to say about the report today. I've issued three letters about it. He didn't want to answer that question. Does that matter to you?
No, I would expect him to say that. I think that Barr would be kind of crazy to show the report to the Oval Office at this point. I mean, he should play it by the book. I think he understands that. He should follow, dot all his I's and cross all those T's and really just, you know, obey the letter of the law. And then release the document in an expurgated form. And I think he's doing that.
What about the relationship between Barr and Mueller? As I understand it, they're working together to generate the report. So people should really, I think, just be patient. I think these hearings would have been better served to have been held next week, you know, when the report actually comes out instead of today. So are the Democrats, and we may have already answered this, kind of setting themselves up for failure by having Barr there today, even though it was a budget meeting? Maybe they should have held off on the conversations today about the report and saved those till next week.
That's a possibility. That makes sense to me. That seems plausible. But I would just emphasize that, you know, I have never seen politicians screw up as badly as Democrats have on this issue. This episode in American politics is really unique. It is a colossal failure on the part of the Democratic Party's strategists. It's amazing. And at this point, they are now desperate. They're grasping at straws. They're hoping that something in the final report will sort of like give them something they can chew on to say, look, you know, we were right all along. There was some kind of substance here. I can't imagine what that will be, but that's what they're hoping. These guys have blown this story sky high. They have screwed it up royally, and they're just like grasping at straws. And guys like Jerry Nadler, or of course Adam Schiff, have just made fools of themselves.
What about Barr's answer about his, what I keep calling his very bad book report, where he says, I was not interested in putting out summaries or trying to summarize, because I think any summary, regardless of who prepares it, not only runs the risk of being under-inclusive or over-inclusive, but also would trigger a lot of discussion and analysis that really should await everything coming out at once.
I think that sounds plausible to me. I mean, the Democrats want to do everything I can to tear Barr to pieces, but I think he's playing it by the book.
My reason for bringing that up is, isn't that what his 4-page letter has done?
Well, yes, but he's right. If he had released a 4-paragraph letter or a 40-page letter, people would be jumping all over him. And they'd be, they'd be criticizing him mm-hmm. and blaming him for bias, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a no-win proposition. So I think he's right. And I think the guy is playing it by the book, and I think that he's entirely correct in doing so. And as I said, that these Democrats are just desperate. They're grasping at straws. They'll do anything they can in order to salvage some shred of respectability, but I don't see how they can.
What about the point of Barr saying he listed the categories of things that are going to have to be redacted, and one of them was information that's the result of the subpoenas and the result of other hearings, where he can go to a judge and ask the judge to allow the grand jury information to be released, and he's saying that he's not going to do that. Wouldn't it be simple for him to do that, just to take that whole issue off the table?
I suppose so. But there's an important privacy issue here as well. We don't want people smeared with a lot of baseless allegations. And this testimony may be unsupported by any evidence whatsoever. So prosecutors have usually been very careful, and liberals have always, stressed the importance of doing that.
Gotcha.
I mean, I think the Democrats have just dug such a hole for themselves. They're desperate.
Oh, I agree with you.
They're flailing about. They're just trying somehow to save the day, and it's just not going to work. The facts are against them.
In fact, in reading this, there's an Associated Press article that came out last week about Rachel Maddow and her ratings. It says that Maddow isn't backing away from her coverage of Trump and his connection to Russia. Her audience has dipped on her 2 days back on the air since the Barr report the Barr letter has been released, and Mueller found no collusion between Trump and Russian efforts, her audience of 2.5 million on Monday was 19% below her average, and it went down further to 2.3 million on Tuesday. They also talk about Fox saw his audience soar to 4 million. So that to me is media evidence of what it is you're talking about on the political side.
Yeah, I mean, totally. These people were making a lot of money. They were making political hay out of this issue. They were riding this issue for all it was worth. They were convinced that somehow the Mueller report was somehow would wind up buttressing their case, and they just completely blew it. The skeptics were validated. I mean, those of us who said there was nothing there, it didn't amount to anything, they were making didn't make any sense.
Real quick, Daniel, I think to where you're headed here, those who, like yourself, like myself, and many others who have been saying, we told you there wasn't going to be anything, many of us are coming under attack for being right.
Yes, exactly right. No good deed goes unpunished. But this is really important. I mean, the facts have come out. I mean, Mueller was presented as the final arbiter, the man who would uncover the truth. And what he came up with was what his supporters didn't expect. And it was a pleasant surprise to all those skeptics out there who thought this whole thing was much ado about nothing. And we have been validated, and by George, I plan to announce that at every possible opportunity.
Well, you've done it here today, Daniel Lazar, author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. As always, thank you for your time. Thank you for your contribution to the Critical Hour, and look forward to having you back.
Thanks so much.
All right, thank you, Daniel. All right, folks, you are listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Two stories that I want to cover in this segment. According to The Intercept, as Black activists protested police killings, Homeland Security worried they might join ISIS. The other story is Facebook and Google face tough questions over white nationalism. Facebook and Google today are seeking to reassure lawmakers that they are cracking down on white nationalism and extremist content online before a hearing of the House Judiciary Committee. With the history in the United States of the COINTELPRO program, or the FBI's counterintelligence surveillance program that focused on civil and human rights activists during the 50s and 60s and into the 70s, I see a bit of hypocrisy, or at least incredible inconsistency here. So for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. First, he's now the coordinator for events of other IPS projects and is a member of Alliance for Peace and Pan-African Community Action, Netfa Freeman. Netfa, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you, Brother Wilmer.
We're also joined by co-founder and partner at Wayne and Reed, a tech consultancy and venture builder, Brian Williams. Brian, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
So, Netfa, let me start with you. Is my sense of hypocrisy at the greatest, at the least, inconsistency here? Should we be discussing these two stories in the same segment?
Oh, no. They should be discussed in the same segment. And I would actually venture to say it's a little bit more complicated than just hypocrisy. I think right now, as you mentioned, their concern over the activities of white supremacists is almost unavoidable because their white supremacists are increasing their activity. They are feeling increasingly threatened by the way the world is going in terms of people of color. And also, we have to look at this thing in terms of what neoliberalism is doing globally to the world economy. And so right now we're seeing these things around the world rising as a result of a shrinking global economy that cannot sustain or fulfill all of the needs of all of the people, and then promises given by capitalism and whatnot not being able to be fulfilled. And so people who hold mentalities like white supremacist mentalities invariably blame other peoples. But why I would say it's more complex is because while they might be looking at white supremacist activities on social media and whatnot, which we were going to get to, probably the designation of black identity extremists by the FBI's counterterrorism department, also did a report that's not part of what the media is not talking about, and it's not part of this this concern they have, is also the rise of what they call ghost skins in every stage of law enforcement. These are white supremacists who hide their affiliations and this affinity for white supremacy, but they're in all levels of law enforcement. And so that would include the FBI. And they acknowledge that this exists, but they're not doing anything about that. But they create something like black identity extremists.
Brian, to Netfa's point, they also have found allegiance and homes in the United States military. But just, Brian, as I come to you, let me just quickly give folks a summary here that in terms of black activists, as black activists were protesting police killings across the country in 2014 and since, federal and local law enforcement who were monitoring these protesters online, they expressed a concern that these activists who were demanding an end to police violence in the United States might join with ISIS. Now, this concern is unequivocally baseless, but that still seems to be their focus. And my question to you, the whole white supremacist issue seems to be handled almost as a one-off, as isolated incidences. But when it comes to dealing with African Americans who are just struggling for civil and human rights, they seem to be a threat to national security. Brian, your thoughts?
Well, that's a complicated interplay of the history of our country, the perception of a threat versus the reality of a threat, right? I'm a black man. I get pulled over more than I should because I'm a perceived threat, but I'm also about 5'6", right? How big of a threat am I? So for me, it's a dynamic of perception versus reality mixed with the history that our country has experienced. So I don't think you'll find anyone who's versed in American history surprised by the size of the perceived threat of African Americans within this country. Also, that same article highlighted the alliance of another perceived threat, that being Islam in general within the U.S., being aligned to black activists to kind of increase the size of the threat, the size of the perception. And when the article mentioned that, I feel like that was kind of an admission of the idea that this threat is being manufactured for the purpose of for some other means, but not necessarily because of its realisticness.
Netfa, Jerry Nadler, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, the House Judiciary Committee, said efforts by media companies to counter this surge, he's talking about white supremacy, have fallen short, and social network platforms continue to be used as ready avenues to spread dangerous white nationalist speech. His talking about the spreading of speech seems to ignore the action that results from that speech, a la what happened in Virginia or what happened in South Carolina, what happened with the synagogue in Pittsburgh. They seem to want to focus on speech and ignore action. But on the other side of the equation, as African Americans are taking action to protest extrajudicial police murder, that seems to be a concern.
Yeah, and I would even go far as to say they're concerned because we also didn't talk about New Zealand as an example, the internationalization of these kind of things. To focus on action and particularly to unpack it will enforce us going beyond like white nationalists, the base level mentality and ideologies, but to also go deep into talk about the pervasive and elusive nature of white supremacy in general. I mean, this is a white supremacist country. It doesn't matter. And so and it's expressed by the fact that it's a settler colony. The indigenous people are you know, relegated to reservations and repressed, and our people are repressed. We are colonized here. And when you think about places like New Zealand or even Israel or even settler colonies in southern Africa, this is where we have the most heightened types of white nationalist type expressions. And so there's two things that they're afraid of, and this is why they can't go too much to talk about actions and have to talk about the base level ideas that they can actually, you know, not align themselves with. They can't talk about the underpinnings of the systemic nature of white supremacy and capitalism. One is they're afraid of us being able to understand the correlations between international policy and our conditions here in the United States. And so once we do that, and they've always been afraid of this thing, and if you can look back, they've always been concerned with black internationalism. And it's always been characterized as, you know, some violence or terrorism. If you look at the legacy, how Malcolm X has been depicted before, now, of course, his legacy, you know, they have to say something else. The Black Panther Party, Robert Williams with the NAACP were always looked at as not as people who were standing up to defend us, which is all they really were doing. They were maligned as violent. But also, with all of these examples and others, we also see an understanding of internationalism, being able to, one, understand the correlations or the consistency of the people of African descent around the world, but also other oppressed people, Palestinian people, people, other revolutions in Latin America or any place else in Asia. And so once that concern, this is where we are right now in this country, where we've seen a rise in us trying to address and look at our oppression, but what we haven't reached and what they are afraid of is us beginning to understand the correlation between international policy and enforce the hegemony over the global order of things.
Brian, how difficult technically can it be for Facebook and Google to not only track this type of communication over their networks, but to actually take action against it? From a technical perspective, because it seems as though we're spinning our wheels here. The folks from Facebook, the folks from Google, they keep coming back to Congress. We keep seeming to have this conversation.
Yes, so there's two sides to that coin. On one side, there is the determination of what is hate speech and how you can define what that is versus what's a joke or what is, you know, education about hate speech, right, where hate speech might be used but in a constructive way to inform, or different elements of sort of context surrounding how to identify actual hate speech versus the use of words that could indicate hate speech. So one of the concerns isn't very technical at all. It's kind of human. It's really understanding the intent of what something is for. There are starting to become some technologies that can figure those types of things out, different forms of machine learning and AI that can do that. Google and Facebook absolutely are leaders in those spaces, so they have access to the tools that can kind of understand the context of intent when words are used in social media. But then when it comes to the filtering, that's where things get complicated. That can look like censorship in some countries. It can look like oppression of your First Amendment rights in the U.S., and that can easily turn into a lot of lawsuits where the individuals have a strong case for winning. It is not illegal to be racist, right? It is not illegal to have an opinion that people disagree with heavily because it's likely wrong. You have the freedom to be an idiot in America, right? So the reality is...
Wait a minute. So let me ask you this, because I don't understand this process. So are there people sitting at monitors that are looking for flag, what I'll call flag, red flag language. And when that red flag language is found in a text message or when that's found in a Facebook posting, it goes to somebody's screen and they then actually read what's being posted? Or is it just an algorithm that identifies that flag language and then deletes it automatically?
It is a combination of both and several other tools. Right now, because that context is so hard to understand, there are some posts that if users flag them or if they have certain words, they'll go to a real person. And a real person will see if it's, you know, in context or out of context, safety. But in other cases, there are some that you can easily identify, and those will either be suspended or deleted automatically. But that doesn't happen so often.
So if I post on Facebook, the Ku Klux Klan is a dangerous white supremacist organization that needs to be abolished in America, will somebody read that and go, oh, this guy isn't calling for violence. This guy is just saying that the Klan is a white supremacist organization, and they're keying on Ku Klux Klan, and they're keying on the words white supremacist.
It depends on their algorithm. If their algorithm says, if you use these words, delete it. In that case, if you use any of those words, you delete it, and that's it. In other cases, if you use these words, we have to send it to a person. So it really depends on that organization's algorithm. So they have the option to do all of those things.
Okay. Okay. Netfa, getting back to what is kind of my real issue here is the way that these two so-called threats are not being similarly managed. And again, the white nationalist side of the equation seems to, whether it's the Timothy McVeighs of the world or the or whoever it might be, these things seem to be dealt with as one-offs. We're not hearing, in my opinion,
right,
the clarion call that there's a real ideological problem and these organizations are American terrorist or there are now reports of churches in New Orleans are being, black churches in New Orleans are being burnt down. But there does not seem to be this common understanding that white nationalism in America is a terrorist ideology that needs to be dealt with in the same fashion that they want to deal with ISIS or they want to deal with any other so-called international terrorist organization.
Right. And then that actually is really should be seen as logical, because by the same token, it should be common or should be accepted also that capitalism is exploitative, that people are suffering as a result of wars, and this is a settler colony that you know rests at the expense of people, the black and brown people who are here. Those are also not things that are commonly accepted. They can't be spoken by politicians. We can't talk about the obscenity of starting Blue Lives Matter bills in a country where police are killing us with impunity every 28 hours. And so it doesn't, you know, it's even things are taboo, like to talk about socialism. It's getting okay now, but only because the masses of the people are accepting it, not because of anything else.
Let me just quickly drop in there. To your point, in this Hill article about the hearing today on Google and Facebook and white supremacy, it says here, Representative Doug Collins, Republican from Georgia, the committee's ranking member, in his opening remarks, accuses Democrats of allowing anti-Semitism to take root in the House because of Representative Ilhan Omar's remarks about pro-Israel lobbying. Those two things are so far apart from...
Right,
you can't even put them in the same chapter, let alone on the same page.
Right,
but go ahead.
But what he's doing is actually standing up for settler colonialism, because Israel is a settler colonial state. There's nothing anti-Semitic about this thing. We're not talking about anti-Semitism or anti-Judaism. We're talking about being anti-settler colonialism,
anti-oppression,
lobby that oppression and repression of peoples. But also we have to remember that that is the legacy of this country. The type of white supremacy that they're not really coming strong against is the foundation of this country. And the extent to which they have to speak out against it or whatnot is pretty much lip service, or has become so humanly, you know, so not, you know, humanly acceptable.
So, Brian, I'll let you close this out, and I'll ask you, is there really anything, as you look at this as the co-founder of and partner in Wayne & Rita, a tech consultancy company, is there really anything Congress can do? Or are we just spinning our wheels for political entertainment?
No, there are lots that Congress can do. But yes, this is a publication means, right? So when newspapers began to engage in libel, the government stepped in and made libel laws so that you can't defame a person and you can protect mm-hmm. yourself against, you know, publishers
right.
who have the means to put out a message. Those types of laws can easily be adapted for the needs of today's audience, right? So, yes, there are things that can be done, but it starts with a solid understanding of what's possible and a real relationship and understanding of the technologies we have. You see things coming out of Europe that are innovative, and those can happen here as well.
Then how can a Congress who doesn't even, many members of Congress, whether that be the House or the Senate, who can't even seem to understand how to use a mouse, how can we trust these individuals to apply the 21st century applications to their 18th century mindset?
Engage the communities, engage the industry, engage the youth, right? Engage the states in Europe, our partners, who do things that are
okay.
That are innovative and make sense, that make the people
okay.
the people happier.
Okay.
Like, I mean, this isn't an impossible thing. We've done harder things in America.
Okay. Netfa Freeman, you got about 30 seconds.
Well, I mean, the only thing I can say is that we also want to see that what's happening on the top echelons of things is that they're actually trying to preempt attempts for us to organize around our self-defense. They want to first discredit it and demonize it and make us afraid to defend ourselves. But right now we have to realize we're in a situation where our survival is at stake.
Gentlemen, thank you. Thank you very much. Netfa Freeman from the Institute of Policy Studies, as well as from the Black Alliance for Peace and Pan-African Community Action, and Brian Williams, co-founder and partner at Wayne & Reed, a tech consultancy and venture builder. Gentlemen, thank you both for your contribution to The Critical Hour.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.